that most people who go into business don't have a model of a business that works, but of work itself. A technician's perspective, which differs from the entrepreneurial perspective in the following ways. The entrepreneurial perspective asks the question, how must the business work? The technician's perspective asks, what work has to be done? The entrepreneurial perspective sees the business as a system for producing outside results for the customer, resulting in profits. The technician's perspective sees the business as a place in which people work to produce inside results for the technician, producing income. The entrepreneurial perspective starts with a picture of a well-defined future and then comes back to the present with the intention of changing it to match the vision. The technician's perspective starts with the present and then looks forward to an uncertain future with the hope of keeping it much like the present. The entrepreneurial perspective envisions the business in its entirety, from which is derived its parts. The technician's perspective envisions the business in parts, from which is constructed the whole. The entrepreneurial perspective is an integrated view of the world. The technician's perspective is a fragmented view of the world. To the entrepreneur, the present-day world is modeled after his vision. To the technician, the future is modeled after the present-day world. Is it any wonder that the entrepreneurial perspective is absolutely necessary for the creation of a great business, while the technician's produces its exact opposite? The entrepreneurial perspective adopts a wider, more expansive scale. It views the business as a network of seamlessly integrated components, each contributing to some larger pattern that comes together in such a way as to produce a specifically planned result, a systematic way of doing business. Each step in the development of such a business is measurable, if not quantitatively, at least qualitatively. There's a standard for the business, a form, a way of being that can be translated into things to do today that best exemplify it. The business operates according to articulated rules and principles. It has a clear, recognizable form. With the technician's perspective, however, the scale is narrower, more inhibited, confined principally to the work being done. As a result, the technician's business becomes increasingly oppressive, less exhilarating, closed off from the larger world outside. His business is reduced to steps that fail to take him anywhere other than to the next step, itself nothing more than a replica of the one before it. Routine becomes the order of the day. Work is done for work's sake alone, forsaking any higher purpose, any meaning for what needs to be done other than the need to just do it. The technician sees no connection between where his business is going and where it is now. Lacking the grander scale and visionary guidance manifest in the entrepreneurial model, the technician is left to construct a model each and every step of the way. But the only model from which to construct it is the model of past experience, the model of work. Exactly the opposite of what he needs if the business is to free him of the work he's grown accustomed to doing. The entrepreneurial model. What does the entrepreneur see off in the distance that the technician finds so difficult to see? What exactly is the entrepreneurial model? It's a model of a business that fulfills the perceived needs of a specific segment of customers in an innovative way. The entrepreneurial model looks at a business as if it were a product sitting on a shelf and competing for the customer's attention against a whole shelf of competing products or businesses. Said another way, the entrepreneurial model has less to do with what's done in a business and more to do with how it's done. The commodity isn't what's important. The way it's delivered is. When the entrepreneur creates the model, he surveys the world and asks, where's the opportunity? Having identified it, he then goes back to the drawing board and constructs a solution to the frustrations he finds among a certain group of customers. A solution in the form of a business that looks and acts in a very specific way. The way the customer needs it to look and act, not the entrepreneur. How will my business look to the customer? The entrepreneur asks. How will my business stand out from all the rest? Thus, the entrepreneurial model does not start with a picture of the business to be created, but of the customer for whom the business is to be created. It understands that without a clear picture of that customer, no business can succeed. The technician, on the other hand, looks inward to define his skills and only looks outwardly afterward to ask, how can I sell them? The resulting business almost inevitably focuses on the thing it sells rather than the way the business goes about it or the customer to whom it's to be sold. Such a business is designed to satisfy the technician who created it, not the customer. To the entrepreneur, the business is the product. To the technician, the product is what he delivers to the customer. To the technician, the customer is always a problem, because the customer never seems to want what the technician has to offer at the price at which he offers it. To the entrepreneur, however, the customer is always an opportunity, because the entrepreneur knows that within the customer is a continuing parade of changing wants, begging to be satisfied. All the entrepreneur has to do is to find out what those wants are and what they will be in the future. As a result, the world is a continuing surprise, a treasure hunt to the entrepreneur. To the technician, however, the world is a place that never seems to let him do what he wants to do. It rarely applauds his efforts. It rarely appreciates his work, and it rarely, if ever, appreciates him. To the technician, the world always wants something he doesn't know how to give it. The question then becomes, how can we introduce the entrepreneurial model to the technician in such a way that he can understand it and utilize it? The answer is, unfortunately, we can't. The technician isn't interested. The technician has other things to do. If we're to be successful at this, what we must do instead is to give the undeveloped entrepreneur in each of us the information he needs to grow beyond the limitations of the technician's comfort zone so as to experience a vision of a business that works. What we must do instead is to provide our inner entrepreneur with a model of a business that works, a model that is so exciting that it stimulates our entrepreneurial personality, our innovative side, to break free of the technician's bonds once and for all. What we must do instead is discover a model that sparks the entrepreneurial imagination in each of us with such a resounding shock that by the time the technician wakes up to the fact, it will be too late. The entrepreneur will be well on his way. But at the same time, if the model is to work, if the model is to awaken the entrepreneur within each of us to begin to rebuild our businesses around the entrepreneurial perspective there so desperately need to flourish, the manager and the technician need their own models. Because if the entrepreneur drives the business, the manager must make certain it has the necessary fuel for sustenance and that the engine and chassis are in a good state of repair. If the technician is to be satisfied, on the other hand, there must be a model that provides him with work that satisfies his need for direct interaction with every nut and bolt. In short, for this business model of ours to work, it must be balanced and inclusive so that the entrepreneur, the manager, and the technician all find their natural place within it, so they all find the right work to do. To find such a model, let's examine a revolutionary development that has transformed American small business in an astonishing way. I call it the turnkey revolution. It was time for Sarah to open her store, and we still had a lot of work to do. "I'll come back tonight," I said. "Can I answer any questions before I leave?" "Yes," Sarah smiled. "How soon can we get started?" Part 2. The Turnkey Revolution. A New View of Business. Chapter 7. The Turnkey Revolution. Systems theory looks at the world in terms of the interrelatedness of all phenomena. And in this framework, an integrated whole, whose properties cannot be reduced to those of its part, is called a system. Friedrich Capra, The Turning Point. The Industrial Revolution, the Technological Revolution, the Information Explosion are all familiar phenomena in today's world. There is no question of the impact each has had on our lives. If asked to describe the turnkey revolution, however, most people would simply respond with a blank stare. Yet the impact of the turnkey revolution on American small business and the inferences we can draw about that impact for the future are as profound as any of the phenomena cited above. For at the heart of the turnkey revolution is a way of doing business that has the power to dramatically transform any small business, indeed any business, no matter what its size, from a condition of chaos and dis-ease to a condition of order, excitement, and continuous growth. It is the turnkey revolution that provides us with that elusive key to the development of an extraordinary business, the ultimately balanced model of a business that works. The franchise phenomenon. It all started in 1952 when a 52-year-old salesman walked into a hamburger stand in San Bernardino, California, to sell the two brothers who owned it a milkshake machine. What he saw there was a miracle. At least, that's how Ray Kroc, the milkshake machine salesman, might have described it, for he had never seen anything like that very first McDonald's, later to become McDonald's hamburger stand. It worked like a Swiss watch. Hamburgers were produced in a way he'd never seen before, quickly, efficiently, inexpensively, and identically. Best of all, anyone could do it. He watched high school kids working with precision under the supervision of the owners, happily responding to the long lines of customers queued up in front of the stand. It became apparent to Ray Kroc that what the McDonald brothers had created was not just another hamburger stand, but a money machine. Soon after that first visit, and possessed by a passion he had never felt quite like that before, Ray Kroc convinced Mac and Jim McDonald to let him franchise their method. 12 years and several million hamburgers later, he bought them out and went on to create the largest retail prepared food distribution system in the world. The most successful small business in the world. That's what McDonald's calls itself today, and for good reason. Because the success of McDonald's is truly staggering. Think about it. In less than 40 years, Ray Kroc's McDonald's has become a $40 billion a year business with 28,707 restaurants worldwide and growing in number every minute, serving food to more than 43 million people every day in 120 countries, representing more than 10% of the gross restaurant receipts in America. The average McDonald's restaurant produces more than $2 million in annual sales and is more profitable than almost any other retail business in the world, with an average 17% pre-tax net profit. But Ray Kroc created much more than just a fantastically successful business. He created the model upon which an entire generation of entrepreneurs have since built their fortunes, a model that was the genesis of the franchise phenomenon. It started as a trickle when a few entrepreneurs began to experiment with Kroc's formula for success. But it wasn't long before the trickle turned into Niagara Falls. In the year 2000, there were 320,000 franchise businesses in 75 industries. Franchises produced $1 trillion in sales each year, almost 50% of every retail dollar spent in the nation, and had more than 8 million full and part-time people, the largest employer of high school youth in the country's economy. But the genius of McDonald's isn't franchising itself. The franchise has been around for more than 100 years. Many companies, Coca-Cola and General Motors among them, have utilized franchising as an effective method of distribution to reach broadly expanding markets inexpensively. The true genius of Ray Kroc's McDonald's is the business format franchise. It is the business format franchise that has revolutionized American business. It is the business format franchise, with one new franchise opening its door every 8 minutes of every single business day, that has spawned so much of the success of the franchise phenomenon over the past 40 years. And according to studies conducted by the U.S. Commerce Department from 1971 to 1987, less than 5% of franchises have been terminated on an annual basis, or 25% in 5 years. Compare that statistic to the more than 80% failure rate of independently owned businesses, and you can immediately understand the power of the turnkey revolution in our economy and the contribution that the business format franchise has made to it and the future success of your business. Turning the key, the business format franchise. The early franchise businesses, many of which still exist, were called trade name franchises. Under this system, the franchisor licenses the right to small companies to market its nationally known products locally. But the business format franchise moves a step beyond the trade name franchise. The business format franchise not only lends its name to the smaller enterprise, but it also provides the franchisee with an entire system of doing business. And in that difference lies the true significance of the turnkey revolution and its phenomenal success. The turnkey revolution and the business format franchise were born of a belief that runs counter to what most business founders in this country believe. Most business founders believe that the success of a business resides in the success of the product it sells. To the trade name franchisor, the value of the franchise lies in the value of the brand name that it's licensing. Cadillac, Mercedes, Coca-Cola. There was a time when that belief was true, but it isn't anymore. In a world where brand names proliferate like snowflakes in a Minnesota blizzard, it becomes more and more difficult and infinitely more expensive to establish a secure position with a brand name and expect to keep it. As a result, trade name franchises have been declining over the same period that franchising in general has been exploding at an unprecedented rate. It is the business format franchise that has accounted for that growth, because the business format franchise is built on the belief that the true product of a business is not what it sells, but how it sells it. The true product of a business is the business itself. What Ray Kroc understood at McDonald's was that the hamburger wasn't his product. McDonald's was. And he believed that for a most important reason. Selling the business instead of the product. Ray Kroc was the consummate entrepreneur. And like most entrepreneurs, he suffered from one major liability. He had a huge dream and very little money. Enter the franchisee. The franchisee became the vehicle for Ray Kroc to realize his dream. At that point, Ray Kroc began to look at his business as the product and at the franchisee as his first, last, and most important customer. For the franchisee wasn't interested in hamburgers or french fries or milkshakes. He was interested in the business. Driven by his desire to buy a business, the franchisee only wanted to know one thing. Does it work? Ray Kroc's most important concern then became how to make certain his business would work better than any other. If McDonald's was to fulfill the dream he had for it, the franchisee would have to be willing to buy it. And the only way Ray Kroc could assure himself of that was to make certain that McDonald's worked better than any of the other business products, the other business opportunities around. At the outset, Ray Kroc wasn't just competing with other hamburger businesses. He was competing with every other business opportunity around. But there was a second reason that Ray Kroc had for making certain McDonald's would work. Given the failure rate of most small businesses, he must have realized a crucial fact. For McDonald's to be a predictable success, the business would have to work because the franchisee, if left to his own devices, most assuredly wouldn't. Once he understood this, Ray Kroc's problem became his opportunity. Forced to create a business that worked in order to sell it also created a business that would work once it was sold, no matter who bought it. Armed with that realization, he set about the task of creating a foolproof, predictable business. A systems-dependent business, not a people-dependent business. A business that could work without him. Unlike most small business owners before him and since, Ray Kroc went to work on his business, not in it. He began to think about his business like an engineer working on a pre-production prototype of a mass-producible product. He began to re-engineer McDonald's decades before the word and the process came into fashion. He began to think about McDonald's just like Henry Ford must have thought about the Model T. How could the components of the prototype be constructed so that it could be assembled at a very low cost with totally interchangeable parts? How could the components be constructed so that the resulting business system could be replicated over and over again, each business working just like the Model T, as reliably as the thousands that preceded it? What Ray Kroc did was to apply the thinking behind the Industrial Revolution to the process of business development, and to a degree never before experienced in a business enterprise. The business as a product would only sell if it worked. And the only way to make certain it would work in the hands of a franchisee anywhere in the world would be to build it out of perfectly predictable components that could be tested in a prototype long before ever going into mass production. Therein lies the secret behind the stunning success of the business format franchise, the launching pad for the turnkey revolution. That secret is the franchise prototype. It is in the franchise prototype that every successful franchisor builds his fortune. It is in the franchise prototype that every extraordinary franchisor plants the seeds of his fortune. And it is in the franchise prototype that you can find the model you need to make your business work. Sarah and I couldn't have picked a better time to have this conversation. If she had ever felt the weight of being a technician-turned-business owner, caught up in the doing of her business and the inordinate price she was paying for it, it was right now. It was 10 o'clock at night. As usual, she'd had a tumultuous day. Her face was flush with the exertion of mopping the floors, bundling and tossing out the trash, preparing the ovens for the next day, cleaning the counters to their original high luster, in addition to a full day of waiting on customers, serving up pie, coffee, and tea, washing, drying, and stacking plates, cups, saucers, and shining the silver. And yet, with all that had gone on in the shop that day, you couldn't have known it. For as always, the shop was impeccable. And despite the cost to her of keeping it that way, I couldn't help but notice the deep satisfaction Sarah felt as she surveyed her domain. But she was obviously tired. We pulled two chairs up to a table and quietly sipped the tea she'd prepared for us. The large clock ticked emphatically on the wall, punctuating our silence. An occasional car drove by the shop. People walked by the shop's windows, occasionally looking into the shop as they continued on their journey into the night. I waited for a sign from Sarah that she was ready. Finally, she began thoughtfully and quietly. "You talk about McDonald's as an example to be modeled. I'm not sure I agree with you about that. I know if my aunt were here today, she would think of McDonald's as exactly the opposite of what you've suggested it is." "Talk to me about that," she said. "I'm interested in how you would respond to my aunt, about what you would say to her." "You know, Sarah," I began, "I can sense that something has shifted in you today, something important. I can sense also from the tone of your question that you're truly interested in pursuing this question about McDonald's, and I'm inspired to engage in the question with you at the deepest level. I want to thank you for that. It's true, many small business owners at first misunderstand my point about McDonald's. They associate fast food with low quality. They infer then that by setting McDonald's up as an example, I'm suggesting that one can be incredibly successful in business despite the seemingly low quality of the product delivered, when exactly the opposite is true. But let me get back to that in a moment. As for your aunt, even though I've never met her, from the way you've described her, I feel I know her. And this is what I would say to her if she were here asking me the question herself. I would say that Ray Kroc was a man with a purpose. His purpose was clear, undiluted, and sure. He lived in an ordinary world, like we all do, a world in which most things don't work the way they're supposed to. At McDonald's, he saw something that did work, exactly as it was supposed to, time after time after time. To Ray Kroc, that was an inspiration. In fact, he was awed by it. He was a simple man, and he fell in love with the sheer enormity of the thing he called McDonald's. As certainly as you loved baking pies, Ray Kroc loved making McDonald's. As certainly as you loved producing an exceptional pie, Ray Kroc loved producing an exceptional result the same way, with the same impact, time after time. As certainly as you loved the aroma, the smells, the sight, the taste of your kitchen, Ray Kroc loved the aroma, the smells, the sight, the taste of McDonald's. He was a man in love. Now, from the outside in, I can understand why you might be critical of McDonald's. You might say that people shouldn't eat meat. You might say that the hamburgers could be fatter or less fatty or this or that. But what you couldn't say, what you could never say, is that McDonald's doesn't keep its promise, because it does. Better than just about any business in the world, McDonald's, the love of Ray Kroc's life, still keeps its promise long after Ray Kroc is gone. It delivers exactly what we have come to expect of it every single time. So that's why I look upon McDonald's as a model for every small business. Because it can do in its more than 28,000 stores what most of us can't do in only one. And to me, that's what integrity is all about. It's about doing what you say you will do, and if you can't, learning how. If that's the measure of an incredible business, and I believe it is, then there is no more incredible business than McDonald's. Who among us small business owners can say we do things as well? But McDonald's is even more important than that. McDonald's has not only created an extraordinary business, it has created for all of us small business owners an extraordinary way to create an extraordinary business. It has created a model we can emulate. And the profound impact that has had on our economy over the past four decades is beyond our comprehension. So, Sarah Zandt, I honestly believe if you had known Ray Kroc, you would have discovered in him a kindred spirit. You would have invited him into your kitchen, and he would have invited you into his. You would have discussed with him with great passion the art of creating a fine pie crust, and he would have discussed with you, with just as great a passion, the art of creating a fine French fry. You would have shared with him your secret for preparing the fruit, just as he would share with you his secret for preparing the hamburger buns he so lovingly devoted himself to. You're two peas in a pod, with one big exception. You, Sarah Zandt, had but one kitchen in which you loved to work. Your kitchen, making your pies, alone, or with Sarah by your side. Ray Kroc had thousands upon thousands of kitchens in which he loved to work, perfecting all the time his ability to touch millions of people with the same loving attention you've lavished on a few. You're a technician, a craftsperson who loves what you do. He was an entrepreneur, albeit still a craftsperson who loved what he did. The only difference between the two of you is an order of magnitude. So let me tell you how he crafted something that size. Chapter 8, The Franchise Prototype. Precision instruments are designed to achieve an idea, dimensional precision, where perfection is impossible. There is no perfectly shaped part of the motorcycle, and never will be. But when you come as close as these instruments take you, remarkable things happen, and you go flying across the countryside under a power that would be called magic if it were not so completely rational in every way. Robert M. Persig, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. The success of the business format franchise is without question the most important news in business. Over the course of 1 year, business format franchises have reported a success rate of 95%, in contrast to the 50% failure rate of new independently owned businesses. Where 80% of all businesses fail in the first 5 years, 75% of all business format franchises succeed. The reason for that success is the franchise prototype. To the franchisor, the prototype becomes the working model of the dream. It is the dream in microcosm. The prototype becomes the incubator and the nursery for all creative thought. The station where creativity is nursed by pragmatism to grow into an innovation that works. The franchise prototype is also the place where all assumptions are put to the test to see how well they work before becoming operational in the business. Without it, the franchise would be an impossible dream, as chaotic and undisciplined as any business. The prototype acts as a buffer between hypothesis and action. putting ideas to the test in the real world rather than the world of competing ideas. The only criterion of value becomes the answer to the ultimate question, does it work? Once having completed his prototype, the franchisor then turns to the franchisee and says, let me show you how it works. And work it does. The system runs the business. The people run the system. In the franchise prototype, the system becomes the solution to the problems that have beset all businesses and all human organizations since time immemorial. The system integrates all the elements required to make a business work. It transforms a business into a machine, or more accurately, because it is so alive, into an organism driven by the integrity of its parts, all working in concert toward a realized objective. And with its prototype as its progenitor, it works like nothing else before it. At Ray Kroc's McDonald's, every possible detail of the business system was first tested in the prototype and then controlled to a degree never before possible in a people-intensive business. The French fries were left in the warming bin for no more than 7 minutes to prevent sogginess. A soggy French fry is not a McDonald's French fry. Hamburgers were removed from the hot trays in no more than 10 minutes to retain the proper moisture. The frozen meat patties, precisely identical in size and weight, were turned at exactly the same time on the griddle. Pickles were placed by hand in a set pattern that prevented them from sliding out and landing in the customer's lap. Food was served to the customer in 60 seconds or less. Discipline, standardization, and order were the watchwords. Cleanliness was enforced with meticulous attention to the most seemingly trivial detail. Ray Kroc was determined that the customer would not equate inexpensive with inattentive or cheap. Nowhere had a business ever paid so much attention to the little things, to the system that guaranteed the customer that her expectations would be fulfilled in exactly the same way every single time. Unlike the trade name franchise before it, Ray Kroc's system left the franchisee with as little operating discretion as possible. This was accomplished by sending him through a rigorous training program before ever being allowed to operate the franchise. At McDonald's, they called it the University of Hamburgerology, or Hamburger U. There, the franchisee learned not how to make hamburgers, but how to run the system that makes hamburgers, the system by which McDonald's satisfied its customers every single time. The system that was to be the foundation of McDonald's uncommon success. Is it any wonder that McDonald's calls itself the most successful small business in the world? It is. Every single extraordinary detail Ray Kroc invented 4 decades ago is even more extraordinary today. Whether it's Hamburger U, or the placement of pickles, or the exacting way in which the buns are warmed before serving, or the thickness of the patty, all of it today, long after Ray Kroc is gone, is still known by the franchisee as the system at the heart of McDonald's. And just as it was then, it is now. Once the franchisee learns the system, he is given the key to his own business. Thus the name, Turnkey Operation. The franchisee is licensed the right to use the system, learns how to run it, and then turns the key. The business does the rest. And the franchisees love it. Because if the franchisor has designed the business well, every problem has been thought through. All that's left for the franchisee to do is learn how to manage the system. That's what the franchise prototype is all about. It's a place to conceive and perfect the system. To find out what works because you've worked it. The system isn't something you bring to the business. It's something you derive from the process of building the business. The franchise prototype is the answer to the perpetual question, how do I give my customer what he wants while maintaining control of the business that's giving it to him? To the entrepreneur, the franchise prototype is the medium through which his vision takes form in the real world. To the manager, the franchise prototype provides the order and the predictability, the system so important to his life. To the technician, the prototype is a place in which he is free to do the things he loves to do, technical work. And to the small business owner, the franchise prototype provides the means through which he can finally feed his three personalities in a balanced way while creating a business that works. So now you have it. The franchise prototype is the model you've been looking for. The franchise prototype is the model of a business that works. The balanced model that will satisfy the entrepreneur, the manager, and the technician all at once. And it's been there all the time. It's been there at McDonald's, and at Federal Express, and at Disney World, and at Mrs. Fields Cookies. It's been there at Subway Sandwiches and Domino's Pizza and Kentucky Fried Chicken and Pizza Hut. It's been there at Taco Bell and UPS and Universal Studios. It's been there waiting for you to discover it all this time. It's been there in the form of a proprietary operating system at the heart of every extraordinary business around you, franchised or not. Because, after all, that's all that any business format franchise really is. It is a proprietary way of doing business that successfully and preferentially differentiates every extraordinary business from every one of its competitors. In this light, every great business in the world is a franchise. The question is, how do you build yours? How do you put this powerfully liberating idea to work for you? How do you create your franchise prototype? How do you, like Ray Kroc, build a business that works predictably, effortlessly, and profitably each and every day? How do you build a business that works without you? How do you get free of your business to live a fuller life? Do you get it? Do you see why this is so important? Because until you do, your business will control your life. But once you begin to put this idea to work for you, you're on your way to being free. I could see that Sarah got it. I could see that the flush on her cheeks now had nothing to do with the work she'd been doing all day. I could see that her dark, intelligent, creative eyes were riveted on mine and that the questions were bubbling within her. She was feeling excitement contemplating the creation of an entrepreneurial business. And she knew she had one already. She could do in her business what Ray Kroc had done in his. All she needed to do was to learn how. Chapter 9. Working on your business, not in it. Form is only a beginning. It is the combination of feelings and a function, shapes and things that come to one in connection with the discoveries made as one goes into the wood that pull it together and give meaning to form. James Krevnoff, A Cabinetmaker's Notebook. It is critical that you understand the point I'm about to make, for if you do, neither your business nor your life will ever be the same. The point is, your business is not your life. Your business and your life are two totally separate things. At its best, your business is something apart from you rather than a part of you, with its own rules and its own purposes. An organism, you might say, that will live or die according to how well it performs its sole function, to find and keep customers. Once you recognize that the purpose of your life is not to serve your business, but that the primary purpose of your business is to serve your life, you can then go to work on your business rather than in it, with a full understanding of why it is absolutely necessary for you to do so. This is where you can put the model of the franchise prototype to work for you. Where working on your business rather than in your business will become the central theme of your daily activity, the prime catalyst for everything you do from this moment forward. Pretend that the business you own or want to own is the prototype or will be the prototype for 5,000 more just like it. That your business is going to serve as the model for 5,000 more just like it. Not almost like it, but just like it. Perfect replicates, clones. In other words, pretend that you're going to franchise your business. Note, I said pretend. I'm not saying that you should. That isn't the point here, unless, of course, you want it to be. Further, now that you know what the game is, the franchise game as I call it, understand that there are rules to follow if you're to win. 1. The model will provide consistent value to your customers, employees, suppliers, and lenders beyond what they expect. 2. The model will be operated by people with the lowest possible level of skill necessary. 3. The model will stand out as a place of impeccable order. 4. All work in the model will be documented in operations manuals. 5. The model will provide a uniformly predictable service to the customer. 6. The model will utilize a uniform color, dress, and facilities code. Let's take a look at these rules in turn. 1. The model will provide consistent value to your customers, employees, suppliers, and lenders beyond what they expect. What is value? How do we understand it? I would suggest that value is what people perceive it to be and nothing more. So what could your prototype do that would not only provide consistent value to your customers, employees, suppliers, and lenders, but would provide it beyond their wildest expectations? That is the question every entrepreneur must ask, because it is the raison d'être of his business. It is in the understanding of value as it impacts every person with whom your business comes into contact that every extraordinary business lives. Value can be a word said at the door of the business as a customer leaves. Value can be an unexpected gift from the business arriving in the mail. Value can be a word of recognition to a new recruit for a job well done, or for that matter, to a seasoned salesperson who's been successful for years. Value can be the reasonable price of your products or the dedication you show in the process of explaining them to a customer who needs more help than usual. Value can be a simple word of thanks to your banker for his conscientiousness. Value is essential to your business and to the satisfaction you get from it as it grows. 2. The model will be operated by people with the lowest possible level of skill necessary. Yes, I said lowest possible level of skill. Because if your model depends upon highly skilled people, it's going to be impossible to replicate. Such people are at a premium in the marketplace. They're also expensive, thus raising the price you'll have to charge for your product or service. By lowest possible level of skill, I mean the lowest possible level necessary to fulfill the functions for which each is intended. Obviously, if yours is a legal firm, you must have attorneys. If yours is a medical firm, you must have physicians. But you don't need to hire brilliant attorneys or brilliant physicians. You need to create the very best system through which good attorneys and good physicians can be leveraged to produce exquisite results. The question you need to keep asking yourself is, how can I give my customer the results he wants systematically rather than personally? Put another way, how can I create a business whose results are systems dependent rather than people dependent? Systems dependent rather than expert dependent. How can I create an expert system rather than hire one? That is not to say that people are unimportant. On the contrary, people bring systems to life. People make it possible for things that are designed to work to produce the intended results. And in the process, people who are systems-oriented, as all your people must be, learn how to more effectively make things work for your customers and for your business by learning how to improve the systems. It's been said, and I believe it to be true, that great businesses are not built by extraordinary people, but by ordinary people doing extraordinary things. But for ordinary people to do extraordinary things, a system, a way of doing things, is absolutely essential in order to compensate for the disparity between the skills your people have and the skills your business needs if it is to produce consistent results. In this context, the system become the tools your people use to increase their productivity. To get the job done in the way it needs to get done, in order for your business to successfully differentiate itself from your competition. It's your job, more accurately, the job of your business, to develop those tools and to teach your people how to use them. It's your people's job to use the tools you've developed and to recommend improvements based upon their experience with them. There's another reason for this rule. What I call the rule of ordinary people, that says the blessing of ordinary people is that they make your job more difficult. The typical owner of a small business prefers highly skilled people because he believes they make his job easier. He can simply leave the work to them. That is, the typical small business owner prefers management by abdication to management by delegation. Unfortunately, the inevitable result of this kind of thinking is that the business also grows to depend upon the whims and moods of its people. If they're in the mood, the job gets done. If they're not, it doesn't. In this kind of business, a business that relies on discretion, how do I motivate my people becomes the constant question. How do I keep them in the mood? It is literally impossible to produce a consistent result in a business that depends upon extraordinary people. No business can do it for long, and no extraordinary business tries to. Because every extraordinary business knows that when you intentionally build your business around the skills of ordinary people, you'll be forced to ask the difficult question about how to produce a result without the extraordinary ones. You'll be forced to find a system that leverages your ordinary people to the point where they can produce extraordinary results over and over and over again. You'll be forced to invent innovative system solutions to the people problems that have plagued small businesses and big businesses well since the beginning of time. You'll be forced to build a business that works. You'll be forced to do the work of business development, not as a replacement for people development, but as its necessary correlate. 3. The model will stand out as a place of impeccable order. At the core of rule number 3 is the irrepressible fact that in a world of chaos, most people crave order. And it doesn't take a genius to see that the world today is in a state of massive chaos. Wars, famine, crime, violence, inflation, recession, a shifting of traditional forms of social interaction, the threat of nuclear proliferation, HIV, Holocaust, terrorism in all its horrific forms are all communicated instantly and continuously to the fixated consumer, to you, to me, to all of us watching TV. As Alvin Toffler wrote in his revolutionary book, The Third Wave, most people surveying the world around them today see only chaos. They suffer a sense of personal powerlessness and pointlessness. He went on to say that individuals need life structure. A life lacking in comprehensive structure is an aimless wreck. The absence of structure breeds breakdown. Structure provides the relatively fixed points of reference we need. It is these relatively fixed points of reference that an orderly business provides its customer and its employees in an otherwise disorderly world. A business that looks orderly says to your customer that your people know what they're doing. A business that looks orderly says to your people that you know what you're doing. A business that looks orderly says that while the world may not work, some things can. A business that looks orderly says to your customer that he can trust in the result delivered and assures your people that they can trust in their future with you. A business that looks orderly says that the structure is in place. 4. All work in the model will be documented in operations manuals. Documentation says this is how we do it here. Without documentation, all routinized work turns into exceptions. Documentation provides your people with the structure they need and with a written account of how to get the job done in the most efficient and effective way. It communicates to the new employees, as well as to the old, that there is a logic to the world in which they have chosen to work, that there is a technology by which results are produced. Documentation is an affirmation of order. Again from Toffler, for many people, a job is crucial psychologically, over and above the paycheck. By making clear demands on their time and energy, it provides an element of structure around which the rest of their lives can be organized. The operative word here is clear. Documentation provides the clarity structure needs if it is to be meaningful to your people. Through documentation, structure is reduced to specific means rather than generalized ends, to a literal and simplified task. The technician in each of us needs to understand to do the job at hand. The operations manual, the repository of the documentation, is therefore best described as a company's how-to-do-it guide. It designates the purpose of the work, specifies the steps needed to be taken while doing that work, and summarizes the standards associated with both the process and the result. Your prototype would not be a model without one. 5. The model will provide a uniformly predictable service to the customer. While the business must look orderly, it is not sufficient. The business must also act orderly. It must do things in a predictable, uniform way. An experience I had not too long ago illustrates the point. I went to a barber who in our first meeting gave me one of the best haircuts I have ever had. He was a master with the scissors and used them exclusively, never resorting to electric shears as so many others do. Before cutting my hair, he insisted on washing it, explaining that the washing made cutting easier. During the haircut, one of his assistants kept my cup of coffee fresh. In all, the experience was delightful, so I made an appointment to return. When I returned, however, everything had changed. Instead of using the scissors exclusively, he used the shears about 50% of the time. He not only didn't wash my hair, but never even mentioned it. The assistant did bring me a cup of coffee, but only once, never to return. Nonetheless, the haircut was again excellent. Several weeks later, I returned for a third appointment. This time the barber did wash my hair, but after cutting it, preliminary to a final trim. This time he again used the scissors exclusively, but unlike the first two times, no coffee was served, although he did ask if I would like a glass of wine.